Welcome to episode 48 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today I'm going to be talking with Ana Valdez Curiel. She is an undergraduate here at UNC Charlotte. She's an activist involved in a lot of different things, but for the purposes of this conversation, I have to note that she was brought to the United States as a young child and is currently a recipient of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. So, Ana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's just start with the basic things. So DACA is intended to protect, young people, not children necessarily anymore, whose parents brought them here, but they are, they were undocumented.
Right.
And so DACA is being debated right now in Congress. So a lot of this is up in the air and there's just a tremendous amount of news on it. What do you think is the most common misperception about people who are under DACA?
So I think what I hear a lot is that DACA is a path to citizenship, and it's not, because it was only meant to be temporary and it's only for 2 years. So you have to renew it every 2 years. So a lot of people were confused on how people were able to obtain their driver's license, maybe a social security number, attend school through DACA, if it wasn't a path to citizenship. So that is a misconception I hear a lot. And like, people ask me, well, you know, if you have DACA, doesn't that mean you can become a citizen? But that's not the case.
Yeah, and I've actually heard a number of people assume not only could you get citizenship, but then you could then try to get citizenship for your parents. So it's just this very weird inflated sense of what benefits DACA gives to people.
Yeah, I think the benefits are misconstrued a lot. You know, you always hear the things about immigrants, you know, not paying taxes, or, you know, just kind of leeching off the system. But DACA puts a lot of provisions in place to make sure you don't do that, like charging out-of-state tuition in some states, or not allowing DACA people to be eligible for the FAFSA, or, you know, not allowing them to vote. So there's a lot of things in place, you know, in order for DACA people not to have the same rights citizens have, but just enough where people can sort of grasp onto that and be like, don't you have this? Isn't this enough for you? So, yeah.
Right. So what do you think? What's the biggest challenge you face?
The biggest challenge personally I face is the out-of-state tuition. And that might be specific to North Carolina, because we have a Republican majority General Assembly. Is that in North Carolina, you do have to pay out-of-state tuition if you're a DACA student. So that takes a big toll financially on me and my parents, because, you know, even though I've grown up in North Carolina for most of my life and I went through North Carolina public school systems and I graduated from there, I'm still have to pay out-of-state tuition. So that is one of the biggest challenges, to find that financial challenge. And then along with being in school, there's a few things like not being able to study abroad, just things like every normal college gets to do. You kind of have to like take a backseat to that.
Right, because of the inability to just easily leave the country.
Right. There used to be advanced parole, but that's kind of been taken away with the Trump administration. There was a lot of just warnings against going out of the country. You could, but it wasn't really advised that you could, that you should, because you might get stopped at an airport coming back and not be allowed to enter again.
Right. So in general, then you say it creates a lot of uncertainties that other people just don't deal with.
Right. So most DACA people, well, I would say like have grown up here their whole lives. So, you know, they're coming to school here, they're going through school, they're getting their degrees at American universities. But if DACA is taken away, then they're not eligible to work. So there's that question of, well, now I have this degree, you know, your bachelor's, master's, or your doctorate, but I can't work. So it's like that disconnect. It's like, what did I go to school for? Because when you go to school, ultimately, you're trying to get a career, get a job.
Right.
But if you legally can't work in the United States, then that kind of leaves you up in the air, like, what do you do now? Or if you can't drive, because, you know, if your DACA is taken away, you can't legally attain a driver's license. So you can't drive and you can't work, but you graduated from school with your bachelor's. So that's what a lot of DACA people struggle with now.
Yeah. Well, and you think too, is that growing up in North Carolina, you and your family were paying taxes.
Right.
Basically as de facto residents of North Carolina.
Right.
So you were actually paying just as much as anybody else. And then it's like, well, okay, even though you've lived in the state almost your whole life, we don't consider you to ever have lived in the state at all. And you never can prove that you lived in the state.
Right. That's true. You know, went through public school system, graduated from my high school, like just like everybody else. But when it came to applying for college, you know, it was put down that I was out of state, basically.
Right. So it strikes me that it takes quite a bit of courage for someone in your position to speak out because you're obviously in a vulnerable spot. But you do. So what prompted you to do that, or what prompts you to continue doing so?
Right. So coming out of the shadows, as they say, is just sort of a conscious choice you have to make with yourself. I knew that if I didn't take up this fight for myself, I didn't know who was going to on my behalf, especially at UNC Charlotte, where we have only about 44 DACA people coming out and saying, hey, I'm undocumented. I'm here. I have different needs than other students. It's hard because at the same time, you're just trying to fit in. And, you know, if your whole argument is that you're American, you know, then like, saying you have different needs kind of just takes away from that. But I think, you know, being in Charlotte by myself, because my parents live like 4 hours from here, I really just took initiative to fight for myself and bring awareness that there's DACA people in Charlotte, at UNC Charlotte, that are struggling financially, you know, and like struggling, honestly, sometimes with their mental health. That is a big thing that comes up a lot. Not something we talk about a lot in the undocumented youth movement is the mental health issues that comes along with being DACA. I've definitely struggled with mental health issues in the past with a lot of anxiety, depression at one point. And, you know, there's no kind of sitting around because you have to like keep going and make sure people are aware that this is happening. And it's not just for DACA. It's also for, we're now including a lot of temporary protected status people too in this, but for specifically DACA students and non-DACA students, there is a lot of uncertainty there and a lot of mental health issues that go on.
Yeah. And so let me just follow up on a couple of things you said. I feel like with mental health, that's something that also you said is not discussed in the youth movement as much. But it's not really discussed that much publicly either, where there's like a certain stress level that's constant, right? That other people just aren't dealing with. We take for granted that we're not stressing about something 100% of the time.
Right. So there's already a lot of mental health things involved with just being a student in general. There's a college student, and those things come up with a lot of peer pressure. But when you're a DACA student, there's sort of like a ticking clock on, right, you know, your status. So there's that added pressure. It's like, what am I going to do when my status expires? You know, questioning, is it even worth it being in school if I'm not even going to be able to work?
Sure.
You know, if I can't study abroad, if I can't, you know, vote in an election, you know, there's just a lot of added stresses to being a student with DACA. And, you know, always having to make sure that you're excelling at everything, because people are just looking for any reason to say that, you know, you're not an upstanding citizen and to take away your status. And that whole idea of the best of the best, always having to be the best of the best.
Right.
There's a lot of pressure there. It's I think a lot of immigrant kids go through that, is that they have to be the best of the best in order to justify,
right,
even being in the country.
Right. And then think of TPS, which is temporary protected status.
Right.
Has there been a lot of interaction between young people who are DACA and young people who are TPS?
There is a form of solidarity between temporary protected status people and DACA people. But I think those fights are, even though they're separate, there's a lot of connections that can be made, because there's a lot of like youth that have parents with,
right,
temporary protected status, And in DACA, it's usually the youth themselves. So sometimes those struggles are different, but we definitely find solidarity there in fighting for temporary protected status people because they do face deportation, just like DACA people.
Right, because it's the same thing where there's a deadline sitting out there all the time.
Right.
And you're waiting for somebody in Washington to decide whether that deadline is going to continue or not.
Right, correct.
And just for people listening, with TPS, under past several presidents, was generally just renewed. That didn't make it great because then you're still, you know, you're still just getting a year and a half or whatever it was. But now the Trump administration has started saying no, that there are some countries that now know you're not going to get TPS anymore, which raises the stress level even more. And now thinking about your activism, you just got back from protests in Washington, D.C. You were at last week. What was the mood there in the both with the people protesting and with the lawmakers that you saw?
Right. So I would say the protest was led by a bunch of undocumented youth, and really it was stressed that there was a sense of urgency. We need to pass a Clean Dream Act because it sort of seemed like lawmakers were sort of toying with our futures, with the deadlines keep getting pushed back. So there was a huge sense of urgency that we need to get our message loud and clear. It was very organized. United We Dream organized a lot of it. And there was several like instances of civil disobedience where Dreamers themselves got arrested by Capitol Police in order to make a point that, you know, this is big enough and important enough to us that we're going to risk arrest. And they did get arrested, you know. And getting arrested when you're DACA is a big deal because that's any blotch on your record could potentially in the future come up in like immigration court or when you're filing for citizenship. So the fact that they were willing to take that risk just kind of stressed the sense of urgency about passing a Clean Dream Act. While we were there, we did a rally. You know, there's a lot of people there. And we held a rally in the Senate building of like hundreds of undocumented youth. And after that, we did Senate office takeovers. So we would go and disrupt in the senator's office. One particular one we did was in Nancy Pelosi's office because the day before there had been some media attention to the fact that she had been on the House floor speaking for 8 hours about Dreamers. So in return, we did a sit-in in her office for 8 hours.
Okay.
To sort of highlight that Nancy Pelosi needs to be whipping up Democratic people in the House in order to pass the Clean Dream Act. And honestly, the mood towards her wasn't too grateful because it seemed like she'd been toying with us and doing back of the House negotiations about the budget bill. So really it was just trying to put pressure on lawmakers that we need a Clean Dream Act and you shouldn't vote for a budget bill without a Clean Dream Act.
Which
they did, yes.
Now, and one thing that brings up the interesting point that a lot of people have talked about how the Democratic Party increasingly is perceived as taking the Latino vote for granted.
Right.
And that the Latino population, whether you vote or not, is just going to support Democrats no matter what.
Right.
And I wonder how much that's really shifting.
Right. I think within the undocumented youth, there's no fooling them. You know, they're not really the champions of the Democrats, to be honest, because they have shown time and time again that they will, when it comes down to it, not stand up for the community as strongly as they should. I would say the Democratic Party does kind of do that, but just with any like minorities, they kind of use their vote. But then when it comes down to it, they don't take a strong stance. And that was kind of, there's a lot of anger directed towards the Democratic Party, a lot of anger towards Republicans too, but I think the anger is more intensified when people are claiming to be on your side, but their actions don't show. So.
Yeah, because you think Republicans are voting the way that you would expect them to vote, and Democrats are saying one thing and then maybe voting a different way.
Right.
Because we went from, well, we'll shut down the government until we have a Dream Act to, well, we'll just have an open debate about immigration, which is kind of where we're moving now.
Right. And I think the urgency also comes from every day 122 Dreamers lose their status. So that means that every day people are losing their status and now eligible for deportation. So you know, I get like things get bureaucratic and like things have to be worked out. But, you know, when you keep pushing the deadline back, that just means more people are losing their status every single day and putting themselves at risk for deportation. So.
Right. Because and that's an excellent point that people don't think about. March 5th is the official deadline.
Right.
And then it'll really accelerate. But people are already losing status every single day. And right. that'll just then continue to increase.
Right. I have a friend actually who lost his status in December. And he's about 30 years old. He had, you know, he went to college, he graduated, he had his job, he was up for a promotion, and then his status expired. And then all of a sudden, like, he can't work. Now he's stuck in the house, he can't drive, he lost his driver's license, and his only source of income is now his mother, who, you know, honestly can't, with the income she has, can't really afford to pay the bills. So now they're facing possible homelessness because they can't afford to pay the bills. So, it is like it does take a toll losing your status if you're like the breadwinner of your family
right.
or you have to work in order to pay your bills. And then all of a sudden that's taken away or even built a career for yourself. And all of a sudden that's taken away. That's a huge, you know, traumatic event on the
Absolutely.
Family that you have to work out. So
Absolutely.
This sense of urgency is there.
Right. Now, one thing that that we talked about before, I think we talked about it a little bit in class, just a bit. There's a debate about the quote unquote good immigrant versus the quote unquote bad immigrant image. So tell me a little bit about that debate.
Right. So this is something that's been coming up recently in the last few years. Is that you know, we talk about immigration and we talk about immigrants in the sense that, you know. It's always well-intentioned, you know, the conversation's always, you know, they contribute to our economy, you know, they have families here, they're doctors, they're lawyers. But what that essentially does, it allows us to criminalize and sort of push away any immigrants that aren't really up to, like, high standards of what we consider in society as acceptable positions. So, you know, and it lets us prioritize those people. So that is sort of the good immigrant narrative. And, you know, it kind of takes away that human aspect is that immigrants are humans too. They make mistakes. And even if they're not perfect, that doesn't mean they don't deserve full human rights. And then the bad immigrant, I guess, would be, you know, the all the criminal aspects that come with being, I guess, like immigrant. But if you mean criminal, I mean like being technically entering the country illegally. And also all these jobs immigrants work that aren't so high profile, like, you know, your everyday jobs, like your working class jobs, like maybe being a janitor or, you know, working in a fast food restaurant. Those aren't the jobs that, you know, we look up into society. So it lets us sort of brush those people to the side and doesn't allow us to work for a solution for those people.
Yeah. And it seems to me too, because there was a bill that's sort of been scrapped that would help protect the parents of dreamers.
Right.
Because you just think of the strange thing where you're saying, okay, the child is a good immigrant.
Right.
They're going to contribute, wasn't their decision, et cetera. But then the parents, who are the ones who actually raised this good, quote unquote, good child, they're bad.
Right.
And that's the logic there is just sort of bizarre.
Yeah, it's asking young people to sort of criminalize their parents.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of us are resisting that because there's a lot of dreamers I've heard say, I'm not going to take a Dream Act if I have to give up my mom and dad, which, you know, that's also like sort of unfair to people. And it does let you like not provide a solution for citizenship in the broader immigration reform conversation for your parents to get citizenship eventually. But that is asking a lot for dreamers and young immigrants to sort of be okay with their parents being criminalized by the government.
And it's a reminder, too, is that so let's say that Congress passes a Dream Act. Well, you're actually not resolving all of the stress for the people who are recipients because the vast majority of them are going to have close family members who are not in the country legally. So that doesn't solve their family problem at all.
Right. It solves the problem for them, but it doesn't really solve the problem for their parents. Maybe they have a sister, brother, uncles, like, you know, whatever. They're still there. They might be safe, but their parents are not safe. And that what kind of atmosphere does that create? One of fear, one of anger, one of anxiety that, okay, if I become a citizen, cool, I have my citizenship, but now what do I do about my mom and dad? They're still eligible for deportation. They still might get sent back. They still might be picked up by ICE. So I'm not going to say it's like the Clean Dream Act isn't like a goal we have, sure, but like in the broader scheme of things, there's more things we're fighting for, but you know, one thing at a time.
Right. So, thinking about you more specifically, you know, with DACA or with immigrants in general, with undocumented immigrants, there's always the sort of the general bad immigrant image. So what kind of career are you looking to? What are you studying here and what do you hope to do with it?
So I am majoring in political science and Latin American studies, and I decided that I also want to be a professor in Latin American studies. That just came to me last year when I was thinking about the things I wanted to do. And I really think education, because I love educating people. I love teaching people. I love talking with people, specifically students, and sort of giving them the knowledge in order for them to stand up for themselves or to fight back whatever they are passionate about. So I want to be a professor and eventually go to grad school and get my doctorate.
Okay, awesome. And you think, like you said, there are 44 other DACA students. I guess I'd heard various numbers. I didn't know how precise any of them were. Mm-hmm. So they all have these kinds of career goals as well, right?
Yeah, right.
So just in general, you think of how many students around the country, how many college students there are. And I've had students who have already graduated who are in the exact same position, who are suddenly facing all this uncertainty. And the idea that we want to demonize so many people who are obviously contributing a lot to society is still rather hard to believe, but mm-hmm. it's true.
Right. I think that is rooted in a lot of xenophobia, but the case for Dreamers is really it's really interesting because there's not a lot that you can point to that is bad about a Clean Dream Act, because in order to even get DACA in the first place, there was a huge list of like stipulations, like, you know, you couldn't have a criminal record, you have to have entered the country before a certain date, like good person, a good moral character, you had to be in school, like things that normally American society looks up to as somebody that's a model citizen. So the case for not letting people that are DACA become citizen is really small, and you have to think, well, where is that? Where is the opposition coming from? Like,
yeah.
Sometimes I think it's just plain anti-immigrant sentiment. You know, maybe some racism tied into that because, you know, a lot of DACA people come from, you know, Latin America or, you know, Africa or the Caribbean. So there's a little bit to look into for that.
Yeah. And just one final note too, thinking of the perceptions of immigrants, particularly from Latin America, that in the Democratic response to Trump's State of the Union, it was Representative Kennedy mm-hmm. gave the response, and then he said, okay, now I'm going to address DACA students, and he said a little bit in Spanish.
Right.
And in class, we talked about that, like, why are you speaking in Spanish to DACA recipients? Right. You're totally missing the point mm-hmm. and reinforcing the idea that these are people who haven't learned English or more comfortable in Spanish or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a little tone deaf to sort of, I understood what he was trying to do,
right.
But at the end of the day, if you're saying that DACA people and DACA recipients are Americans too, then if they're Americans, all of them speak English.
Right.
So switching to Spanish was sort of like, you know, it was sort of hurting the cause a little bit and sort of, you know, taking away from the messages that we're Americans too. We've grown up here. You know, we've gone through school here, we speak English. And it sort of just pinpointed people from maybe Latin America, but there's DACA people from different countries that don't necessarily speak
right.
Spanish.
Exactly.
And DACA people that don't, like from Latin America, that don't even speak Spanish just because they literally grown up here their whole lives and they're not bilingual and they've never had to speak Spanish. So that was a little tone deaf, I would say.
But, yeah.
You know, well-intentioned.
Right. Okay, with that, we are out of time. I've been talking to Ana Valdez Curiel, who is a DACA recipient here, a student here at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Ana, again, thank you so much, and thanks for all of the work you're doing.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.